Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Alicia Warnless, and we discuss her book, The Information Animal, which explores how disinformation, strategic communication, and the competition for reality are reshaping our world, and why we urgently need a new ecological approach to understanding the information environment. I think this is a really interesting episode. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Alicia, welcome to the podcast. It's wonderful to meet you.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
I was just saying to Alicia off air, I'm a big fan of a show called Dog Shirt TV, which you're a regular contributor of. And we have a little guest star today from Dog Shirt TV, which is the cactus, but minus the batteries and the cool intro. But for the benefit of listeners who are not familiar with you and your work, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Right. All right. So I'm Alicia Walmas. I am a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which is a think tank based in D.C. I am Canadian. I lead a project there called the Information Environment Project, where we work with multi-stakeholders to foster evidence-informed policymaking regarding various aspects of the information environment.
Yeah, fantastic. And I hear you've got, and I can see you've got quite the collection of sort of propaganda posters and artwork.
This is true. It runs throughout the house. I was very interested in things like propaganda and nationalism, language engineering, basically things that leaders were using to manipulate masses for a long time. I did my undergraduate degree in Russian, where I started looking at some of these things way back when.
Yeah, fantastic. I suppose when you were studying Russian, was it at a time where it felt like the Cold War had kind of ended and we're kind of in this new world? Because obviously now that seems to have changed a lot and it feels more relevant than ever.
Not to date myself, but I started that degree in 1999.
Wow.
And there was like zero to no interest in Russian. Our program at the time was under threat of being shut down. I'd actually been pulled into interviews with the institution to try to argue for keeping it open.
Good for you that you did.
Well, it's interesting because then years later, what I found was that people probably in our demographic, there was a total lack of local Russian expertise. We had lots of people coming in from Central and Eastern Europe with that expertise, but I read one article at one point that said that we were basically unicorns because they just weren't being encouraged produce whatever, the funding for programs was being cut, and so this was a huge issue, and it became an issue more recently.
Yeah. So Alicia, you've got this wonderful new book called The Information Animal, and I was wondering if you could just sort of tell us a little bit about why you wrote that book and how you went about researching it.
Right. So I wrote the book for a multitude of reasons. I think in part because I was not finding a very good explanation of how the information environment worked anywhere. At the time when I started doing this work around 2014, there wasn't a lot of discussion about that outside of military circles. And their definitions were kind of like a listing of various parts that kept getting longer and longer. It felt like as it went along, there was like one spot for the longest time, which was this American joint publication 313. On influence operations or information operations, rather, that had a definition in it. And so the more I was sort of digging, the less I was finding an explanation for that. And at the same time, I had been working in like strategic communications. And one thing that was really bothering me was that there were always these big claims about the effectiveness of strategic communication campaigns, but there wasn't a whole lot of evidence to prove that they were working or not. And so that was kind of what was driving me to look around where those campaigns were happening to that wider environment And ultimately, the question became, if we're talking about something like an environment, why aren't we studying it like the physical environment is studied?
Yeah. And how did you kind of go about sort of researching the book itself? Because quite a few interesting sort of case studies within it.
And so there's something I don't advise anybody to have to do, which is my PhD, and also pilfering from your PhD for research on that. So what happened was, again, back around this time, 2014, 2015, I started thinking about going back to school to do more research. I had been working in strategic communications. I just felt like I wasn't getting the answers that I was seeking. And so I started doing some work with academics just to understand things like how propaganda was changing in the digital age, if indeed it was. Mm-hmm. And that led me to this pursuit of a PhD, which I did at King's College London in war studies. Ultimately to try to understand how you would develop a theory. So I spent 4 years during plague times mostly working on this PhD, which included the 5 case studies that are in there. The book then is a complete rewrite, including new theoretical chapters around things like information ecology, the information environment, and also information itself, as well as some other things like about Finland.
Fantastic, fantastic. So I was really good to talk to us today about sort of the concept of information ecology and how it sort of took shape.
So because I was looking at how we would study this if we were to borrow from methods from physical ecology, that's where it really sort of starts from. So I am not an ecologist as background, as I already said, I majored in Russian. And so that required kind of a deep dive while I was doing the PhD just to understand how the physical environment is understood. Where did ecology come from? One of the things that came out in my explorations was a great story about Alexander von Humboldt, who's this Prussian naturalist. Before he's around, the way that scientists were looking at the physical environment was really mechanistic. There's this kind of a belief that animals are basically machines, humans are somehow separate from the natural world. It exists for us to just exploit. Researchers were looking at things like botany or animals, zoologists. They weren't really looking at it together, and they weren't really putting it in the context of the system. And so along comes Humboldt, and he goes off to South America, starts his first expedition, and he really starts to see that what we're dealing with here are complex ecosystems. And if you do something like the colonialists have been doing in Lake Valencia, what is now Venezuela, clear cutting the trees, you're going to kill that ecosystem. It's going to lead to soil erosion. You know, the fish are going to die. Like, everything's just going to end badly. And so he also started to see that there were patterns around the world, right? So his hypothesis was that you have similar ecosystems, similar things happening in different places. And so he did eventually get to Russia to be able to start to prove that. But one of the other things I really like about what he did was in his big book, Cosmos, he realized that he couldn't possibly be an expert in all the different emerging sciences that were happening. And he corresponded with hundreds of scientists to piece together this very systemic understanding of the world. And so to me, this is very much an inspiration of what we need right now to understand a very complex system in the information environment. We need to be able to have a shared language, have a shared understanding, know how different fields fit together, and find ways to have scientists from different fields actually collaborate and make sense of this complex space.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find sort of academia gets a bit siloed by topic and people just sort of view everything kind of through that kind of lens?
I think that's definitely the case, especially in Western academia. We're very much encouraged to be in a silo, in a specialization. Even when you're doing a PhD, you're encouraged by your supervisor usually to do something narrow so that it's manageable. So I think in that way, we actually discourage a systemic thinking when what we're facing, not just in the information environment, but even like in climate change and all of these other kinds of complex sprawling institutions are complex problems. And so we do need a matter of systemic thinking that currently I don't think is being fostered at universities.
Yeah. You describe in your book humans as information animals. So what does that mean?
So humans very much are driven by information, right? Our whole idea of a shared reality, how we understand things, how we communicate, this is all driven by information. Our ability to understand how to react in the world is built by information. So I think that it's really at the heart of our existence. It's encoded in our DNA. It leads to our physical, you know, natural responses to certain things, like a startle response, or like I said in the book, knowing that you're cold and putting a sweater on. And so this is, I think, fundamentally what makes us, right? It's one of the things that makes us. So this is how I see us as being information animals. Also in the sense that we don't really even know or even think about information, right? It's so integral to our day-to-day existence that unless it's something super obvious, like a book in front of us, we might not even recognize what it is.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And we sort of touched upon this, but why do you believe that the way we currently study disinformation and media threats is flawed?
I mean, it's flawed in the sense that we tend to observe the problem, right? Like we've stopped at basically looking at a problem that we think is challenging us, and we collect case studies that exemplify that it exists. Maybe we get so far as to say, well, we think that it might be causing this other problem. But that's kind of where it stops. And we don't even do like a lot of longitudinal analysis across those case studies to understand how it's changing. And we certainly don't end up putting that into a wider context. So what we're doing is we're kind of looking at a surface level, and we're looking at it in bits. And we don't necessarily understand how it fits into a wider system where people are processing lots of different types of information, their experiences, their education, their current economic status. All these things might be going into shaping how they're responding to something. But we look at that one little bit that might be disinformation, and we make big assumptions about it having a massive role. It may or may not. But again, looking at it in this kind of isolated way means that we aren't really seeing the bigger picture. And it means that we also aren't really understanding that particular problem as well as we think we are.
Yeah. So what would it mean to treat the information environment like an ecosystem? And what are the sort of practical implications of that?
I think it already is an ecosystem, right? One of the things that stands out to me is that we use these metaphors, but we don't really conceive them as being the complex systems they are. So one thing is, I think, just accepting that we're dealing with a complex system that involves humans, the means they use for processing information, the outputs that are created by that, and how these three things interrelate. They form these ecosystems that are quite complex and also shaped by surrounding conditions like economics, climate, socio-political things that may be happening that may be impacting it. And if we look at each bit in isolation, again, we're not necessarily seeing how that system forms and how it works. I think if we understand how that works, we can start to see how something like a new technology may be changing that ecosystem. We may be able to understand what certain interventions do or don't do. We may be able to identify certain factors that actually create greater resilience within an ecosystem and foster those. So it may be something like adult literacy level. I'm talking literacy level, not even this other concept of media literacy. It may be that underlying issues related to housing or health aren't being met, and they're making people more vulnerable. It could be other things that you can't really change, or maybe you shouldn't change, around demographics, such as homogeneity of a society, et cetera. All of these things may be creating, you know, a certain situation that either makes a country more resilient or not to a variety of different threats.
Thank you for that. So how can lessons from environmental sciences guide us in managing disinformation and algorithmic harms? That's an interesting phrase, the algorithmic harms.
I'm not going to touch the algorithmic harms one bit, because just in the sense that I hate what I've become. My husband likes to tease me a lot, because when I started out writing years ago, I was very frivolous with my words. And he would be like, definitions matter. And now I feel like I've become this definitional dictator, in which it's like, but what do you mean? And I don't want to sound like Jordan Peterson. But harms is a challenging one, because it's hard to measure unless there's something really tangible there. And it's a term that often gets used for a lot of these problems that makes it challenging. So set it aside for a second. I think in taking a systemic approach, what we can start to see is, again, how that system works. So in the physical world, I'll take the example of acid rain. I don't know if you remember acid rain. I feel like it was long forgotten, but it was a big part of my childhood.
Yeah, I remember it in the like early 90s and stuff. I don't know. Yeah, it seems to have disappeared now. But
well, because it was addressed, and they found out kind of how to address it. But basically, you know, you have this problem where industrial pollution is sending chemicals up into the air. It mixes with precipitation, comes back down in acid rain. It was a known problem since the 1800s. Because of industrialization, somebody found that there was this increase in acidity in the rain, and it was leading to destruction of, you know, things around it. Then what happened from the 1800s onwards was long-term measurements. So you had international long-term measurements of like rain quality. So the pH levels in rain across different places, near and far from places of pollution. And this still wasn't necessarily enough by the 1980s to prove, because again, what you get is industry saying, no, we're not causing it. It has nothing to do with us. You can't prove it. But those long-term measurements started to be able to prove that, again, that they were very much just surrounding the area where pollution was happening. And in Ontario, where I'm from, up in northern Ontario, Sudbury was a very industrialized area, and the lakes around the city were just dying off, and it was really bad. But we also had another long-term project that was this Ontario Lakes project that had pristine lakes around northern Ontario that hadn't been touched. And so researchers were able to then go and manipulate a very pristine lake to see what would happen if they increased pH levels. And sure enough, they were able to replicate the same problem that was happening around industry. But they were also able to find out how to deal with the problem. So once they stopped increasing the pH levels, it allowed the lake to rebound, but they were also able to introduce alkaline to help. But there were bacteria that also helped eat the acidity in the lake. And so there were a bunch of these measures, along with regulation to stop air pollution, that in the end have helped these lakes rebound. And so it's more complex. We know that pollution causes it. Pollution ending it isn't necessarily going to be the total answer. You may have to have under intervention points. And you also need to have regulatory approaches that may enforce certain rules around the problem spot. So you're looking for multiple points of intervention. So I guess the shortened way of saying this is that, one, it helps you prove causation, right? A complex system is going to allow you to know which types of variables may all be considered so that you can start to rule some of them out. Looking at it as a system is going to tell you how it works. You're going to know how different things move through there. And there's lots of other examples like DDT that help you, you know, understand what's going on. The third thing is, if you take an approach that they have taken to the environment, which is long-term measurements of the same things over time, you're going to have stuff to be able to compare against, which is not what we have currently. And I think all three of these things then lead us to more systemic approaches for dealing with problems that we perceive to be really bad, like disinformation. So you may not be dealing with disinformation directly. You're looking at the system around it to ensure that when disinformation occurs, and it's going to occur, there's nothing you can do to really stop this. It's a human phenomenon. Even if it's, you know, the difference between intentional and non-intentional disinformation versus misinformation, you have to basically try to create ecosystems where it's not reacting in quite as negative way as we perceive disinformation to be as a problem now.
Yeah. This actually might be a good point to ask this, actually, in terms of timing. What's the difference between disinformation and misinformation? Because the terms get interchangeably used quite a lot.
I think that there's also been lots of debates and lack of consistency in how they're being used. I would say, and I think this is more the mainstream view of it, misinformation is misleading or false information. And disinformation is misleading or false information that is deliberately spread. So the difference between it is intentionality. Now, This is a really academic kind of term, because what happens if disinformation, once it's in that information ecosystem, is shared by people who believe it, they don't think it's untrue, then it becomes misinformation. So it's one of those definitions where it might work when you've got the length of time to look back at something. And also, you can determine intentionality, which is pretty hard because you don't really know whether people believe it or not. It's in their head. So that's kind of the difference. It's not great definition creation for policymaking.
Yeah, because I can think of examples where, you know, people who are, should we say, conspiracy theorists end up sharing information that may have come from a hostile state like Russia without realizing that it's been shared by Russia to kind of cause problems. But they kind of believe the content. That makes sense. Yeah.
Right. And also, I think what happens is we take for granted that people could come to similar conclusions to what is being put forward by RT or others on their own. And then we immediately assume that this has been caused by Russia, but there's many ways in which they could have come to this. And I think that that's, again, pointing to the complexity of how people process information and where they get it from. But we also tend to, I think, oversimplify a lot of these issues, right? Especially in like media coverage about it and policymaking about it. And so, I mean, in the past few years, I've watched many people be accused of being Russian trolls or, you know, my brain is fried right now. There is a term for this.
Oh, useful idiot?
Useful idiots, yes. They are. And I just don't think that that's overly helpful because we don't necessarily, I mean, yes, you could say that, but now you're being derogatory towards a person and you're certainly not going to get them to come along with your point of view.
Yeah. If you went and said to somebody, you're a useful idiot, you're not really winning them over. It's not a good hearts and minds strategy, is it?
No. And I think that's kind of the problem with dealing with disinformation as a policy measure in the first place, because once disinformation is present in an information ecosystem, what it tends to mean is that there's a portion of the society that believes something that is either faultily shaped or not true. And once that's there, you're talking about having to basically, for lack of other words, go inside their head to convince them of something else. And that's not going to be perceived well by most people when a state is involved. And add to that, if there's a sizable population that believes this, it's only a matter of time before some politicians are going to jump onto that because it's going to be useful for them in terms of having votes. And so then it becomes this politicized problem really quickly.
Yeah. And also, like, some of the most effective, should we say, lies or disinformation strategies shared online have a grain of truth in them. And that little bit of truth is the thing that people kind of latch onto, which then leads to this sort of cynicism that kind of persists in our society. But yeah.
This is something that I've been struggling with and talk about in the book, is what forms truth? What's the idea of truth? I mean, I think that it can be satisfying, I think, for some people to want to believe that there are hard ground truths on something that everybody should have to accept because they're based on scientific fact. Now, part of me, I mean, obviously, I believe that science can prove things. I'm a big believer in science, and I am advocating that we adopt a more scientific approach when trying to understand the information environment. At the same time, there's many different ways in which people form their own truth. And, you know, that can be, it's based on the information available to them, but they can also process that information in a way that's faulty. I think there's lots of people who did that when it came to the COVID vaccine and how quickly it was produced, and then not believing that it could possibly have been produced safely that quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same thing is like on opinions. People form truths based on preferences or social norms. There's all these things that go into it that make it not as cut and dry or as black and white as many people who want something like disinformation or truth as the defining line to be used in policy.
Mm. So how do concepts like information pollution and information flooding affect democracy and public trust? That's quite a loaded question, that one.
I mean, it's a really loaded question when I wrote an entire book saying that I don't know if we can actually know those things right now if we haven't been studying the system the way that it is.
Mm.
Short of jumping to conclusions that there's a direct cause and effect, I don't think that information pollution is very great for a democracy, especially when it's being wielded by, you know, political actors trying to seek power. And I think also in pushing narratives that are misleading and also stoking fears about other people or institutions, public institutions in particular, like state media, public broadcasters, government, the bank of a nation, et cetera. I don't think that will end well for that democracy and how that society forms. I mean, we're facing this problem in Canada, as many democracies are.
Yeah, because people like to latch onto the term social media. And a lot of the organizations that kind of own the social media platforms that we use, a lot of them make obviously significant money from engagement. And unfortunately, the content that engages people tends to be content that could be described as misinformation a lot of the time. You know, some of the most popular podcasts, not being jealous here as being a podcaster myself, but some of the more popular podcasts on YouTube are getting like phenomenal numbers whilst we don't. And I like to think that we make an effort to put out sort of quality, well thought out information whilst there are other podcasters out there who tackle similar topics who don't take the same level of care that we try to.
Well, this is 100% the problem even with news media. So years ago, one of the things that I was looking at was how media headlines were changing. I was looking more at the kind of BuzzFeed phenomenon, and even the established and wonderful, I will always praise regardless, the BBC. I do think that public media, public broadcasters do need to exist and need to be supported. Even it had moved towards this kind of BuzzFeed-like headline, like eye-catching clickbaity headlines. And so when you have even news broadcasters moving into the space, competing for attention, there's probably going to be a deterioration of what gets through. It may not be that the content is bad, but like everybody's competing for sensation. That's what news is, right? And so I think that this is really the issue that is kind of at the crux of all of this. Now, again, coming back to policy, there's this line of thinking in which if only we gave everybody accurate and good information, that somehow this is going to address the problem. But it doesn't seem like people really want to consume that. We seem to seek infotainment. Let's call it infotainment. It can be absolute rubbish, but it is more on this kind of like entertaining, piquing certain emotions that, you know, get people to react. And yes, social media enables this in particular because anybody can engage and people's engagement with it is what drives what gets shared. And I think there's all sorts of questions now, too, that are emerging in the face of the Trump administration 2.0 around sovereignty in information ecosystems where we've become so dependent on American technology.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Yeah. And the other flip side to that as well is obviously because social media is kind of an international space, you're kind of getting points of view from all over the place that you as the consumer might not be aware of the, should we say, the bias of the individual who's spreading it because of their locality or something.
That's exactly the case when you look at a lot of American politics and this idea that anything that may be for the social good is somehow communist, right? Like how quickly somebody gets branded a communist just for wanting to have social programs. And I think that it's those kinds of worldviews that are formed within ecosystems and information ecosystems that then shape how people go on to process information. And then in that, I don't think that I'm not quite sure that many of our countries right now are preparing us for living in a highly, you know, connected information ecosystem, much less a highly globalized one, right? So, and it's not just that the internet connects us internationally. There's been so much movement of people in a way that allows people to remain connected that has, I think, shaped really where we are now and our understanding of that and our preparation for it is just not happening.
Yeah. And and just speaking very widely, I think that's part of why we're seeing such a popular sort of backlash because like, I grew up in the 90s where it felt like the world was all, you know, things were getting better, the world was more connected, globalization, etc. And then it seems to be we're trying to do the opposite now. And we live in a very sort of different world. And I feel like hope sort of semi-disappeared now, you know, from our discourse.
Sadly, yes. And I mean, I remember what it was like to have to get books from the library and then, you know, get interested in something that you saw in that book and then get your librarian, because I grew up in a rural place in Canada, to get that book in from like Guelph or somewhere else. And then when the internet came, how amazing that was. And I also remember, I think back, if my parents are going to watch, they're now going to know. I don't know how parents could be comfortable with their kids just going out completely online now, because I don't know who I was talking to. I mean, it's terrifying when I think back to it, how much could have gone wrong. But I feel like that brief period in the 90s, it was it was definitely utopian, right? Like, I don't think we were worried about the things that are happening now. And now you've got these like nihilistic gangs that are grooming kids online to do like self-harm. It's insane. And again, like when I think about this, we can get really fixated on that problem, and it is a problem. It does need to be addressed. But if we don't step back and start to look at where that system is and what's happening, all we're going to be doing is trying to create, you know, seatbelts for something that we don't even know is a car.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And I again, speaking widely, I worry a lot of parents are not... I don't know if media literacy is the right word, because we're going to probably talk about that in a little bit. But it's I feel like there's some parents still who are a bit dismissive of social media. It's just, it's a harmless thing. And I don't think as many parents are aware. I mean, hopefully they're getting more aware now, but they're not as aware that if their kid's on Facebook, there are risks and they could be kind of co-opted by bad actors.
Sometimes I wonder if... I mean, there's this cognitive bias among people that is kind of victim blaming, and it won't happen to me, so it won't happen to my kids. So I wonder how much of it is just born out of kind of wishful thinking or ignorance. I think, again, the media coverage doesn't necessarily help. So what happens in coming back to why we need this kind of systems perspective is that so much of the research, whether it's in psychology, communication studies, social science, is not replicable. Like the rates of replicability vary, but like it can be as low as 30%. And what that leads to is a really easy way to sow doubt as to whether social media is causing harm or not causing harm. And this, of course, can really readily be exploited by anybody, whether it's people who want to fan fears, but also more importantly, companies who don't want to have regulations put on them. And so what we end up in is this kind of area where nothing can really happen. Everything is debatable. And so perhaps some parents are just like, I can't even make sense of this. I can barely make ends meet right now. We can't buy a house. You know, all of these other things that just make it be like, whatever, if this makes you happy, use this tool. It's keeping you distracted.
Yeah, 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 definitely. I think the economic thing definitely plays into all this, because people, you know, it feels like a lot of people are just sort of so focused on making the bare minimum or their bills that they haven't really got time to kind of concern themselves about wider issues, which, you know, it's hard. It's hard keeping on top of it all. Yeah.
Right. Which is also what I think makes them so susceptible then to, you know, politicians who want to fan those flames or, you know, make simplistic arguments that the current government is causing this. Now, that's not to say that your current government might not suck. It probably can. It's like there's all these things that are happening. I think that's the thing that I keep coming back to is like, I feel like we really want to have hard answers where we haven't put in the work or the type of thinking that's going to get us to hard answers, but also we have this idea that everything can just be reduced to a simple cause or a simple solution, or it's black or white. And I think until we kind of accept that, accept the complexity, accept that there's so much gray, I'm not sure we can navigate our way through it. But then to come back to the kids, I mean, I think, yes, media literacy comes up a lot. There's some challenges with it in terms of it's not necessarily uniformly applied. So it's really hard to understand whether it is having the impact that it, you know, you want. Does it work everywhere for the same curriculum and different contexts? Probably not. But there are other things that we've had for a long time, like literacy, numeracy. There's issues around risk. Humans are notoriously bad for understanding risk, but I don't remember us being taught in school how bad we are at this and what that's going to mean for our lives, right? It's not just about learning math here. We need to understand that we're going to make really poor decisions because we don't understand risk. So how do we foster means for coping with that? I think people bring up critical thinking a lot, but again, maybe it's a different type of thinking. And this is where I worry about the introduction of things like ChatGPT.
Yes.
We don't encourage people to connect dots. We're not really teaching that or patterns thinking. And now we're like, here's a tool that is going to give you all these answers, but you won't actually have the capacity to know whether those answers are reliable or not.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's quite complex stuff. That. Let's take a break and be right back with more. Thank you. So you mentioned that disinformation is often a symptom, not a cause. Can you elaborate on that distinction?
I think that in part is some of the things that we've been discussing, right? We see that there's been an increase, let's say in Canada, there's been a perceived increase that you have a percentage of the population, especially coming out of COVID, that now no longer trusts the government. It readily maybe believes things like CBC is biased, or this public broadcaster is biased and controlled by a liberal government and they dictate what it says. This isn't true. Yet there's a population that believes that this is the case. And I think that is a symptom of a wider issue. You know, they felt that the lockdowns were really punitive and hard for them. Perhaps they didn't have the same experiences in, again, processing information around vaccines. They didn't trust that they, were being developed quickly and safely, or, you know, lots of other things. This is a facet also of perhaps social isolation because of those lockdowns. It could also be an issue with economic fluctuations. It could have been an issue with declining literacy rates. Canada's had some problems with adult literacy levels. But again, we're not even collecting good long-term data on that to understand how that's changing over time. So it could be a multitude of things that are happening within that ecosystem. And what we see then is that there is this acceptance for disinformation. That's what I mean by it as a symptom. If you have conditions that lead people to being more readily accepting of it, something else is happening.
And speaking from my own personal experience, so a long, long time ago, I fell down a path of conspiracy theories and took me a good few years to kind of get out of it. But what I realized when reflecting back on that period of my life, it was masking a more personal problem. And it was kind of, and so it was a kind of an avoidance strategy of dealing with that personal problem. And I think with a lot of people who sort of turn to conspiracies and things, I feel like, especially when observing some of the people I knew, a lot of that does appear to be the case. People are kind of escaping from something. And as we've talked about, like social economics and things like that, that are not exactly fantastic, can be what they're trying to escape from.
I also think that they offer a very simplistic answer for why things are bad or problematic, a lot like religion has in the past. And so it's a lot easier to accept that maybe things suck for you and the people around you and things aren't great and it's getting bleaker when you can blame some, you know, international cabal that is, you know, making this happen, or a deep state. And so I think they're convenient excuses. I think they also offer this kind of sense of mystery, right? Like you feel like you're uncovering something that somebody else doesn't know. And so you're kind of in that heroic pursuit. So you're almost creating your own narrative while you go down it. There's many reasons why it's likely appealing. And I think, again, we tend to focus on the piece of content, that narrative or, you know, the lie or whatever it is. And we assume that it causes all these things, but likely it's this kind of path and simple solutions and ideas.
Yeah. One other random anecdote I'll just add that came to my mind that kind of feels relevant. Many, many years ago, I met a makeup artist, a Polish makeup artist who was a flat earther. And I'd never met a flat earther in person before, and I couldn't help but find it slightly amusing. And we had a bit of a chat about it, and I showed her a video of some guys sending a hamburger into space to try and prove that the earth was not flat, because it was anything I could think of. And the video was pretty good, actually, but it didn't convince her. But what I realized, it was actually because she grew up in communist Poland, and she got into a mindset that anything the government says is going to be a lie, so I should believe the opposite. And I see this happen a lot, where a lot of people will look at something in, quote, unquote, the mainstream media, which that term gets thrown a lot around, and they will think to themselves, well, if the mainstream media is saying that, then I probably should think the opposite. And I think that's a very dangerous path as well, that seems to be growing as well.
Yes. And I noticed this too in the pandemic, in particular, around who was rejecting vaccine enforcement and rules, and the kind of idea of a vaccine passport. That was predominantly, there were a lot of friends from Eastern Europe who felt that this was, like, again, some sort of communist imposition, and they didn't want to be in a dictatorship again. So there's this fine line between how do you come up with public health measures that ensure that people are safe when people don't want to follow rules. And if you go too far in imposing those rules, then it quickly looks and feels like something that is more authoritarian. And the thing is, sometimes it doesn't even have to be actually more authoritarian, but if people come to believe it that way, this is, again, this challenge. I think media, there's so many challenges with media, like there are so many challenges with social media. Yeah. And again, I'll disclose, I did work for a tech company for a while. I've worked with almost every stakeholder type that would be involved in dealing with problems with information. And to that end, there are people who criticize me for being tainted simply because I did that. But I also think that it gave me a good perspective of how those companies work, what's happening inside of them. And coming out at the other end of this, again, with Trump 2.0, I've got lots of questions around whether we should be allowing corporate interests and individuals to control major portions of communications technology, especially if it's going to be international. But I'll park that for a second. What I worry about in terms of media and looking at the history of media is that we have this interesting nostalgia in the West, this idea that because media can perform an important role for holding governments to account, that it somehow always does that. Yeah. Or it is not a business itself. And I think that if you look at it historically, and there's a good book by, Brooke, and her last name is failing me. She works at NPR.
Oh, I'm not sure on that one, actually. No.
She did a history of media, and it's a graphic novel, and it's excellent. I'll Google that in a second. And it really shows, again, like, you know, you had this kind of low quality news media, particularly in the 1800s, and you had yellow media that was like raising scares for war. You had even, you know, the founder of the institution I work for, Andrew Carnegie, buying up news outlets in the UK to influence elections way back when. And so there's always been this kind of problem and tension and sometimes low quality. And so we talk about media like it's a monolith. We also kind of, I think, romanticize about it for the role that it can perform, but forget that it's also quite complex and can easily lose the trust of people. And I think also the speed at which they're dealing with news, it makes it a lot easier for them to be attacked now, which is sad because, again, we're all in this race to the bottom to get attention. Which, Chris, you're not going to get attention for this one because I'm talking too much and it's long and boring.
Well, good news is I was reading something just the other day saying that the assumptions about Gen Z and attention span are all wrong, and they're happy to sit down or watch a 5-hour podcast about something, but they'll just consume it at their pace. So don't worry about long answers.
You know, this whole generational divide thing I find interesting, and there's like this genre of it in reels online, and I don't know. I think it's...
Well, you and I probably fit in the millennial camp. So I was born in 81. And I find the millennial label kind of interesting because I think most people talk about the millennials who are 10 years younger than me. And so I find that there's nobody talking about any millennial experience I've had that's at all relevant to me. And I didn't grow up with the internet. It came in the very latter part of my my teenage years. The internet, I think, came in my life around about when I was 16. Hugely different to somebody 10 years younger than me.
They
so how can we be
Zennials.
In the same category?
They made a special in-between place for us where it's like we had all the freedom of Generation X and all of the being ignored of Generation X, but we're more comfortable with technology like millennials are, even though we remember what it was like before we had it. I mean, my first computer was a Commodore 64. That thing wasn't connecting to anything.
I remember this. Yeah. Those are cool computers. Used to make a lot of noise.
Lots of noise, and you had to know how to boot it. Like, there's all these things where I think take for granted that especially kids now don't have to worry about and don't know, which again leads me to wonder, not just about them. Like, we worry about older generations. We worry about everybody, essentially. There's some problem with everybody. But, like, if you weren't necessarily seeing how these things function, you don't know the layers underneath it. You don't necessarily know how it might be manipulated as well.
Yeah.
And so I feel like all generations are going to require ongoing help to continue making sense of a changing information ecosystem.
Yeah. Very good point. Well, one interesting thing you brought up in your book as well is about like how information competition can contribute to polarization and potentially violence or war. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that. And you use sort of case studies about Vietnam and Ukraine with that.
So the case studies I used in the book started with ancient Greece and ended with Ukraine, and then the look at Finland in context of, or in juxtaposition to the Canada and the U.S. was a bit different. I will caveat that, again, I was in war studies, so obviously very interested in war and how they start and what happens there. So my case studies are limited in that sense. It would be interesting to see countries that didn't end up in war and maybe were the conditions different. But I was specifically looking at the period before wars broke out, but after new technology was introduced that changed how people processed and shared information. And there were some patterns that emerged there. One of them being, as you mentioned, this a new idea would emerge in that ecosystem that challenged pre-existing views. In Vietnam, this was different ideas about independence and how that should be structured, which challenged colonial views from the administration that wanted to keep it under French rule. And what would happen in these ecosystems is that as that new idea was emerging and using various technology available to it to engage publics to win them over, typically the pre-existing idea and government leaders would then use the same technology to try to compete. Mm-hmm. So they were fighting to have the public adopt basically their worldview. But one of the things that I was noticing in all of them was that ultimately those ideas would become incompatible with each other within that ecosystem. Like you couldn't have both ideas and have them continue to exist because one would end up having to dominate to create a rule. They were just too opposing. So for example, in the United States, the abolition versus slavery, right? Like you cannot have these two things exist at the same time in the same space because they are completely oppositional to each other. Same thing in Vietnam. It's not a matter of like half independence. This is independence for Vietnamese based on Vietnamese ideas versus the French.
How are states and powerful actors weaponizing the information environment today, intentionally or unintentionally?
I guess I wouldn't necessarily say weaponizing because that would be using it as a tool. I think that they're operating within it. And so it depends on who we're talking about. It's clear and quite evident that Russia uses various means to try to influence different information ecosystems. It definitely had been doing that in Ukraine for a long time. Sometimes not necessarily through proxies, but like oligarchs who were sympathetic to Russia bought up media outlets a long time ago. They're not operating as much now in that context because of certain laws and the fact that Russia invaded. There's also the sowing of disinformation. They've had basically farms that were started up to push that. It's quite famous. So they would use social media and different websites. They also have their own state broadcaster, which is a little different than public podcaster in the sense that it doesn't follow the same transparency rules that, say, the BBC does at all. And so they would use this as another means. Also to sow discontent from other places. So it's been a voice, particularly for disenfranchised politicians, fringe politicians in countries like the UK to give interviews.
Yeah, Russia Today, they love having a disenfranchised politician on. Yes.
And they've been doing it for a long time. And so so you have this where it's kind of like a coordinated effort. The one thing about the Russians is that they do have a more systemic sense of the information environment. They also have a concept that they put forward around information struggle. Now, they formed their worldview out of what they thought was being done to them, coming back to countries that had really strong conspiracy theories about always being under threat. And so they basically started forming their responses based on what they thought was being done to them. But also, you know, you could say that you can see similar things being done by other Western states. The question is whether they have rules around what they're doing that make it better or seem better or done for reasons that we share as being acceptable. So in the past, in the US, you know, that's included things like Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, which were using news, and I would argue in a less biased way, but it did have this angle of promoting democracy and democratic values. And so strategic communications is another way of trying to convince people of what you would like them to do or what you would like them to think. Again, the lines here are kind of euphemistic. People who are working in strategic communications would love to tell you that it's completely ethical and that they're following rules and they're truth-telling. And that's the thing that makes it different, that as we've been discussing, sometimes truth can be quite slippery. So you have, you know, different techniques. Sometimes it's manipulating digital environments, right? So trying to manipulate search engine returns. This is all things that marketing companies do that are offered. Like search engine optimization was a big thing for a long time. I think that there's definitely hacking going on. Hacking, I use the term loosely, use of things like ChatGPT to try to game the results. But again, like these are all things that have been done forever. And there's lots of different types of actors that do it. So yes, you have state actors. Yes, you have ideological actors. You have proselytizers, like the ideological actors, they're the same thing. They have a worldview, some sort of belief that they want other people to adopt, and they are trying to manipulate the information ecosystem to get other people to adopt that. You have people who are making a profit off of it. So it can be people who are selling those services, whether it's advertisers, marketing, tech companies, whatever. And this goes back to ancient Greece with people teaching others how to be persuasive in ancient Athens to get people to go along with them when you have a democratic system. So this has long happened. It is like you've got archetypes of different characters or actors who do this in an information ecosystem. It's definitely ongoing between states. There's lots of questions around ethics and how far the manipulation goes before people lose agency that I don't think we have great answers to.
No, indeed. Let's take a break and be right back with more. You also describe in your book about how research itself can be used in information competition. So I was wondering what you meant by that.
Well, I think there's multiple ways in which research gets caught up in this. I mean, the obvious one, and I get asked this a lot, is, so let's say we take this systemic approach. How do you know that it won't be abused by bad actors to, you know, manipulate people in information ecosystems? And the shorter answer is, it's possible. I mean, every kind of approach to understanding the world can be used for good or bad, just as every tool that gets put out there is going to be used for good or bad, and a lot of stuff in between. I would also state that just because we don't foster that doesn't mean that people like Russians, the Russian state, for example, don't already have a better understanding of it. And so we're just putting ourselves in a bad footing for not having a better understanding. Now, I don't think that they're understanding of the system scientifically is that advanced. I just think that conceptually they've accepted that it's a system. But there's another way in which researchers are under attack and it's being politicized. And I think that's quite clear in the US right now, especially the whole community that was working on disinformation is heavily under fire from this current administration. And so just the act of exposing somebody for sharing something that is misleading or false is now something that, you know, is easily politicized and puts that researcher at risk.
Yeah, this is the thing. Actually, risk plays a big role in what you research on, because if you research against something that's not politically what's the word I want now? in fashion. It's like, you know, it can be a great risk to you, yeah.
I think, and again, this is kind of this problem with disinformation, right? Like if this line to say what is right or what isn't is truth, but so much of it can be construed as opinion. And then add to that, if the thing that is really offensive is that it's intentionally done, proving that that's the case is really, really difficult. And again, once it's taken root, how do you then continue to try to advocate for policy measures directly on that? I think that's where it ends up being something that can be politicized really easily. And then it becomes this kind of losing game, right? Because it doesn't matter that you may have a large portion of society that is more susceptible to these narratives, and they may all end up on one side of a political spectrum. If they perceive that the government that is in power is not on their side, now you have this potential belief that it is overreach. Right. So there's it's like you can't get out of it. There's a chicken and an egg issue here, which is why there needs to be some way of looking around the system again to see what you can look at objectively to be able to create conditions that would make that less salient, to take the salience away from it.
Yeah, I agree. And my next question, I kind of feel like I know the answer to just by what you're saying, but are governments and institutions currently equipped to safeguard the information ecosystem, or are they part of the problem?
I mean, that's a very, it's very general. I think it depends. It depends on which, you know, government you're looking at. I can't say that I can point to a government that I've dealt with that really understands the complexity of what it's dealing with. Okay, I'll back up and I'll explain this differently. One is that I don't think the research community has quite articulated the information environment as a system. Again, we aren't bringing different disciplines together to make sense of it and to figure out how it works as a system. So there's one chunk that's broken, right? Like, we are all working in silos. We don't see this. But then the government also works in silos. So one, it doesn't have a proper conceptualization for what it's dealing with. It's only looking at, in most parts, threat-focused approaches. And then that's what gets the media attention. That's what gets a minister interested. And that's what says, we need a solution for this. And so somebody gets a mandate to look at foreign interference, for example, or like cyber threats. And then what happens is you get this kind of sea of mandates. Everybody has their narrow mandate. They're very protectionist about their mandate on top of it. And nobody's tasked with looking across that. And so there's a lot of things that fall within this kind of gap because we're so focused on responding to threats or so focused on, you know, doing strategic communication or something, that there is not this kind of systemic or comprehensive approach even inside a government. Now, this is particularly problematic when you start to deal with something like the information environment, because the government is not the only actor, nor should it be the only actor. If you want to get people to come on side, you start to talk about this or look at this concept of a whole of society solution, which is often discussed and, again, poorly defined. But if you're looking at an information ecosystem, you would inevitably have to have some sort of whole of society solution that does engage citizens in a meaningful way. But if you only have kind of government with singular mandates operating across silos, trying to come up with an approach that's going to get citizens to, I don't know, change their behavior, I think inevitably that's going to fall apart. It's not sufficient because it will always be perceived potentially as being top down. Now, one other thing that I keep coming back to is that I wonder how many of us researchers, policymakers, have any real sense of what average people are facing and dealing with, right? And I don't think we're meeting people anywhere near where they are. We see that their actions are perhaps problematic, and we think we can find solutions to have them stop being a problem.
Indeed. And it's funny when you mentioned sort of any, the other thing as well is an inherent cynicism of anything kind of government led. So that doesn't always help either.
A colleague of mine at UBC here in Canada, Heidi Tvorak, and I recently wrote a piece arguing that historically governments, when they were worried about sovereignty, at least in Canada, created a public broadcaster. And it started with radio and then happened with TV. And this was a, you know, for us, a concern about encroachment from the US. So there's a model that could be applied to create public good infrastructure, perhaps a social media platform that could, it would have to rival the experience of existing ones. It can't just be crap. And, you know, you'd have to have data portability and all these things. We were thinking through all that. So we were basically arguing why and how this could happen and perhaps how you could have it distributed and connected to, you know, others in friendly countries, right? But, you know, it conforms to different laws. Things have changed. It's possible to build this. Now, this got shared in a local community group where I live. And the immediate response from people I know was like, this is horrible. This is government propaganda. And so now there's this question to me of like, it isn't even enough that if government is the only actor, it's not going to work. If government funds the solution, is it going to be acceptable? And so then who has the kind of social authority or capital to be able to engage people? And this is where I keep coming back to, like, we're going to have to engage people who are working on very different models, like deliberative democratic processes. Like, how do you go out and engage people more meaningfully? And I can't shake that this idea that it's almost like democracies were so obsessed with the power of social media to topple regimes, we failed to see that we also had to adapt, and perhaps democracy had to adapt to accommodate, you know, these changing forms of communications. And I still don't think that we've quite got that.
No, I don't think we do. And it's interesting, you just mentioned the term about, like, so I can't remember the phrase you used now, but it was sort of about the social capital of government these days. I think that was the term you used. You know, who has social capital in our society now? Because we are becoming so cynical about governments, and it is making it very hard to kind of then cut through, should we say, more hostile information efforts that are designed to kind of wreck our society in some way.
I keep pulling on a bunch of different threads. And again, because it's a multitude of different areas and problem sets, and no single person is going to have all of the expertise and answers to be able to address those things, which is why we have to pull things in. But one thing that has been striking me lately in looking at this kind of whole of society solution, you can take the democracy shield as an example in the EU. I don't know if you've been following any of that, but the EU is now going to have a democracy shield. And a lot of it comes down to tracking and countering foreign interference. So foreign information manipulation and interference, which is, like, again, just kind of surface level. But what strikes me is that when we end up coming up with these solutions that we make seem systemic, we are only really ever engaging the people we think need to have a seat at the table, either because of their research or what they're doing in terms of operations. But because we haven't stepped back and look at the system, we're probably missing lots of people. So one thing I find often is that you may have a disproportionate number of people who work in disinformation and fact checking at the table, but you actually don't have anybody from proper education. Or you don't have people who are doing some other type of social outreach, like the social listening stuff or deliberative democratic processes. They're off somewhere else entirely. And we might not even know that we need them if we don't step back and kind of see what the sum total of an information ecosystem is. And in that regard, this is where I feel like we need to maybe be more creative in what those solutions are to reach and hear people. And it's going to require a lot of patience. It's going to require perhaps using skills like mediation that have not been brought out, right?
Indeed. It's interesting you mentioned about real educators being at the table, because we had problems in the UK, and we probably still might do, actually, during the war on terror, as we call it, where basically universities were allowing extremists a platform because they were sort of mistakenly seeing them as the voice of the oppressed. And so if you've got those sort of people who are not part of that conversation, then you're going to miss that problem. And I think it is a huge problem, and probably still is now. We had, about 10 years ago, had sort of battles of who could be on stage and who couldn't. There was a lot of deplatforming going on, which I think's calmed down a bit now. I could be wrong. Might be just in my own bubble now, but I don't notice as much deplatforming as I used to. But
you just had an attempt at it at Glastonbury, right?
Yes, we have had an interesting thing going on at Glastonbury. Yes, indeed.
But this, I mean, the whole idea of platforming, deplatforming, you know, it predates the internet. And there's this debate, you know, about who has the right to speak and doesn't. And this kind of this ongoing control over an information ecosystem. But to your point on extremism, one of the things that was, again, this probably fed into why I ended up doing the book that I did, was that I had worked in complex areas like Syria, conflict issues before, and I had dabbled in or looked at the whole countering violent extremism space and what was happening there. And one of the things that was standing out is that we're not taking lessons from that entire field and experience and applying it to countering disinformation. It was like it was totally lost.
Yeah. Well, it gets labels as racist now. A lot of counterterrorism measures that were brought out in response to the rise of jihadism and Al-Qaeda and ISIS has almost been completely dismissed in some circles because they now just view it as it was a racist endeavor. And so we should forget about it. And I think that's problematic. But as a whole, maybe a whole other podcast, that one.
But even that, right? Like, if that is how something ends up being perceived and how it was done, and let's say it was, I mean, there's lessons to be learned in terms of how there was designs or approaches to policy that should be considered before anybody goes and comes up with a policy around disinformation. Because again, no matter what you're looking at a group of people who have formed some sort of community around some sort of a belief, whether it's religious or that the world is flat. And now you are trying to get them to stop because you perceive it to be a problem. And whether it's falling under religious, ethnic, or, you know, just pure belief lines, or economic status, like there's all these dividing fault lines that are, that make it precarious.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a good word, precarious there. There's definitely no easy answers in any of this.
that's the main point.
Yeah, true. What one thing that you do propose is a new interdisciplinary field in information ecology. So what would that look like in practice?
So I think it would very much draw from physical ecology and earth sciences to build a field. So one is identifying what types of disciplines need to be involved there, going out and making sure that we're speaking a similar language. So do we have a shared definition of what the information environment is, what ecosystems are, how that particular field, whether it's media studies, political science, computer studies, like there's endless fields that feed into this, how they fit in, how they interrelate. And then I would say in giving that kind of a frame, perhaps it becomes easier for people who are in specific disciplines to be able to put their research into context with other fields. To do that is a different question. Another colleague and I, David Scales, are working on something right now, exploring how we could learn from general medicine, so generalists in medicine, because that was something that had to be fostered again in the 50s because everybody wanted to be a specialist and there were no GPs. And this became an issue because not everybody needs a specialist, and who actually starts to make sense of the body itself and how these things interrelate. So I would say if we can have a field like information ecology and we can articulate what that is, perhaps you start to insert one course across those fields that introduces people to the idea, introduces them to how their field relates. And perhaps we can start to, one, teach more people about it. Maybe some people go and start to specialize in information ecology to look at ecosystems. But also we teach people who do like media studies how their field interrelates to that. And then perhaps their research can start to be structured more like that. So, I mean, I come back to the health consultant's example of like EDT again. Maybe this would be the answer to help as social scientists and psychologists conduct experiments that could conclusively prove that a certain technology was causing a problem or not.
Mm. In your book, you mentioned Finland is often being held up as a media literary success story. So why should we be cautious about copying such models?
Finland is my favorite example. So Finland, okay, every time you go to any kind of conference related to these topics, somebody inevitably brings up Finland as this dream situation and how if we just did more media literacy like they did, everything would be fine. Inevitably, those people are never from Finland. And I was super happy to go there in March. And I was very nervous about the book. And the response was like, media literacy was not a panacea. And people really need to stop saying this about us. So Finland's just a very unique information ecosystem if we look at it ecologically. It's a small country. It's about 5 million people. It's super homogenous, like over 80% ethnically Finnish. Their language is not one that is really easily understood by other people, maybe some Estonians. But they're also, despite being very introverted, or at least telling everybody that they're introverted, they're also very multilingual. They travel abroad a lot. They have a very pressing memory of the wars with Russia that happened in the 20th century. They're very concerned about Russia, and they have been, you know, fostering defenses and stuff in juxtaposition to that. They didn't have independent foreign policy until the Soviet Union collapsed. So there's all these reasons why it may be different. It's off the charts on things like quality of education, gender equality, economic equality, all things that if you look at the U.S. just are not the same, right? They have a strong public broadcaster that is trusted. People are still tuning into news media, traditional media. You look at the U.S. and we don't really even have a great concept of how ethnically diverse it is. The way that it goes about even trying to capture that stuff is very race-based. It's really quite icky and problematic. You know, the education level vary across the country. Country's huge and sprawling. you know, the main language is English, which everybody in the world practically speaks. So it's very easy to come in and contribute or be a part of that ecosystem. So it has none of these conditions that would maybe be applicable, such that you could say, even if we could say media literacy was the answer in Finland, let's just apply it in the US and it's going to work. It's not likely the case because we're not dealing with the same type of ecosystem.
Do you see a way to foster public trust in science and journalism amid so much manipulation and noise?
I have a hypothesis
that the more complex systems become, the more distant people are who have no experience with them, and then perhaps the more easily they are led to not trust it. And I think this is like a problem of our time, right? As we've built up more and more knowledge, as we've built up increasingly complex systems to deal with, you know, a massively growing world population that moves around, complex economies, all of these things, the average person grows farther and farther away from any one of those given systems. And I think the less they understand about them, the harder it is for them to maybe always just blindly trust. Then the second thing I would say is sometimes I think we talk about these things that may be misleading. I know I keep saying this, but like if you look at societies, and it's not about science and stuff, but if you look at societies where there's like low levels of polarization and high rates of trust in media, they may not be societies you want to foster. China comes to mind.
Authoritarian states sometimes come to mind,
depending on, you know, what kind of what is happening there. And I think there's always going to be a tension in society where you're not going to have everybody believe the same thing. And you don't want everybody to believe the same thing or have the same opinion. The question is, how do we create a society or foster a society in which we can have constructive debates and come to acceptable conclusions that lead a society forward in a positive way? And I think that may be what's missing. So to answer your question about can we foster trust for scientists, I mean, I think a lot of it starts in school. Again, we tend to focus on trying to teach them the subject. Well, it may be to the point where some of these subjects are so complex, what we need to be teaching them about is their role in society first, what it means, and how we should be engaging it or not engaging it while creating pathways forward for people who want to be scientists, but also pathways for people to be able to understand how science fits in and how they can make sense of it from a layperson's perspective.
So what advice would you give to policymakers trying to regulate AI or social media in a way that protects democracy?
That's, again, a very difficult question. I think, and they're two separate issues. So one question, and I kind of raised this at the very end of the book in more of a discussion than having answers, is I do think that societies, democratic societies in particular, need to have a very frank conversation about this argument that competition drives everything and that we should just be releasing new technologies without any form of testing. I think that there are pre-existing models, like in drug testing, that we could be applying to new technology that could give us a path forward to understand whether it should be just generally introduced into the wider information ecosystem, or you have isolated uses, like in a very controlled ecosystem, like a hospital, for example. But there should be some sort of testing that happens before that just generally gets released. And that's in particular when I think about something like AI, generative AI, whatever the application is of this. But to do that, you'd still have to understand the ecosystem so that you would have somewhere to be able to test that would replicate kind of real world examples. I think that trying to react to situations and then put in regulations, say, around disinformation, I think are really challenging and probably aren't going to end very well. Anything at a content level is going to be challenging unless it's on the most egregious topic like child abuse. I think that people will end up debating it. But there are other things that we should have in place that we don't really have across the board when it comes to ICT companies. Transparency regulation. Like, we should be able to understand who owns these things, what kind of infrastructure is there, who's using it, what kind of, you know, costs are there for people. And looking at it both from companies having to be transparent about what their company is, how it actually functions in that particular market, but also from the consumer side. So how are they experiencing it? Are they using it? Why or why not? This is, again, why I think we need to kind of have this more systemic approach and then look through what kinds of factors might need to be assessed after the book. My colleagues and I at Carnegie did come up with a framework for doing that kind of baselining across 16 categories of factors.
I've always wondered whether individuals who are on the internet who can share anything on Twitter, Facebook, etc., should also themselves face some sort of regulation. Because, you know, if we're a public broadcaster, you have to go through Ofcom in the UK. So it means then you can't make certain inflammatory statements without getting fined or whatever. Do you think the burden should also be thrown on the individual to behave more responsibly on the internet?
I think there's been some debate about making people individually more responsible for what they share. I think that gets challenging pretty quickly when we consider the scope of how much is getting posted. And also then yes, tools are available to do this kind of monitoring, but do we want to live in a society that does that level of monitoring? Because in the past, right, if somebody said something out in public, unless it was slanderous, this wouldn't be an issue. And I'll just caveat there that we should also be looking to pre-existing laws and how they can be applied, right? Like we tend to forget that there are past laws around speech and what problems, you know, they have that we don't apply. But then I think the question really becomes, should we have different categories of actors that have greater responsibility? And I think that's pretty cut and clear. You brought up the example of, you know, media regulators in the past and how they've controlled things. Years ago at our project, we had a great article that was written about this idea. And the comparison was to ham radio versus mass broadcast.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so, you know, ham media operators could only ever reach a small audience. And so therefore, there were fewer restrictions and hobbyists can engage in it. But the minute that you wanted to have a bigger kind of platform, you had to abide by rules. So we could apply, again, more traditional approaches to people based on, you know, objective criteria like their audience size. And then if that's the case, you can start to have, you know, some sort of procedure to enforce that they demonstrated before they got that or that they hit the threshold, that they understand what the rules are, that they understand what the implications will be if they run afoul of that. You know, you could have measures in place to deal with debates about this. But if you create that kind of process, then you have some sort of agreed upon system in which people who get that wider audience have to be beholden to that kind of regulatory process. So I think that there are ways that we could adapt pre-existing approaches that would be less creepy than surveying the entire society and policing what they say, and also ways to take away the whole like intentional argument, right? Because again, you're never really going to know. But if, you know, they go and say something that is blatantly false, it doesn't matter whether they believed it or not. They knew that this was going to run afoul of their media broadcast rights.
Yeah. What gives you hope that we can build a healthier information environment? Or does anything give you hope?
I mean, the first thing is we need to figure out what a healthy information ecosystem even looks like. Right now, we're making a lot of assumptions based on democratic values, which feel really nice, but they're not necessarily rooted in any kind of scientific approach. So I think it's possible for us to start to understand the information environment in terms of information ecosystems. It's possible to understand that. And from there, over time, as we make comparisons, we may be able to understand what constitutes healthy. And then from there, we may be able to identify what kinds of factors need to be fostered to make that happen in that particular context. It's not going to be a one size fits all. So I think my hope is that looking back at fields like physical ecology and where they started, you know, it's a long path, but once it's kind of been articulated, if we can see how we all fit in together as researchers, perhaps we can create a field that is capable of finding these answers and doing that. It's my longer term hope.
Yes, that's good. Well, the last meaty question, is there anything else you'd like to add that's important to you that we may have missed?
Sometimes I think this overemphasizing, and we do this even on topics related to the information environment, we paint adversaries as being so sophisticated, so beyond us, so challenging, and often they're just as flawed and dealing with just as incompetent systems as we may be facing ourselves, because humans.
Yeah. Alicia, the last question today is, and it's the most important question, where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
There's two places. To make it simple, I do have a personal website that's legeneralista.ca, but obviously you can find me at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the website there is ceip.org.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really great chatting. We've really enjoyed this.
Thank you. It's been fun.
For listening. This is Secrets and Spies.